for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. It may be hard to draw too many conclusions from yesterday's primary votes. In Arizona, Republican Senator John McCain won easily, but in Alaska, with votes still being counted, Tea Party favorite Joe Miller has a slight lead over Republican incumbent Lisa Murkowski. Joining me to talk about results, what they tell us about voter sentiment with midterm elections just about 10 weeks away, Norman Ornstein. He's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Ron Elving is Washington editor for NPR. And Reed Wilson is editor-in-chief of National Journal's Hotline. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing from you. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Morning,
good morning,
Diane.
And Ron Elving, polls really didn't predict such a close race in Alaska. Lisa Murkowski, according to the headlines, is on the verge of losing.
She's behind. She's behind something like 2,000 votes with just a handful of precincts yet to report. So we're looking at absentee ballots, and that's quite a large factor in Alaska. In fact, a couple of years ago, when Mark Begich knocked off Ted Stevens, the late Ted Stevens, that race was decided by the ballots that came in after they had finished the election day counting. It was decided by the absentee ballots, and we have many of those yet to come in. We don't know exactly how many. We know quite a few went out in the teens of thousands, so we don't know how many of those will actually be returned, but they're going to count them in September. The two waves are not going to be counted fully until September, so we could be looking at as late as 2 days after Labor Day, September 8th, before we have a final winner. On the other hand, it is also possible we could have a clear winner before then, but just to set it out there at the extent of the uncertainty, it could be very close and there could be a recount.
But how come late September or after Labor Day, Norm Ornstein?
Well, this is Alaska, and they had 16,000 requests for absentee ballots. It takes a long time for those ballots actually to get into the central counting place, and then they count them by hand. You know, this has happened before, and you might think that Alaska, having had this experience, would try to move to expedite these things, but it doesn't work that way.
Reed Wilson, what does being an anti-Washington establishment candidate mean in a state that gets so much from Washington?
I think one of the things we learned from this primary is that it doesn't really work to talk about your accomplishments, even in a state, as you say, which gets more back per capita than any other around the country. If you take a look at candidates around the country, those who have talked about what they have been able to do for their districts, people like Alan Mollahan in West Virginia, Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick in Detroit, even folks like Arlen Specter, Bob Bennett, you know, all folks who were great at bringing pork back to their area, they've all lost. Lisa Murkowski spent all of her time talking positively about what she had done for the state rather than going after Joe Miller and sort of dressing him down. And in another one of these primaries, the primary with Senator John McCain in Arizona, he spent all his time going after his opponent as opposed to talking up his own accomplishments. So I think that what we've really seen here is that the anger against Washington really exists, but that's really going to impact anybody who's coming home and talking about what they have done positively for the district.
So what does that make you infer, Norm Ornstein, from just the Alaska picture?
Well, I do think with Alaska, you've got a couple of factors here. One that did play in some other states, which is Lisa Murkowski voted for the TARP program, the Troubled Assets Relief Program, back in the final months of the Bush administration. If we're going to look at one thing that triggered the kind of populist anger out there in the country, it was the TARP vote. And, of course, it's hurting Democrats and hurting Obama, even though it happened under Hank Paulson and George W. Bush as much as it is others, but particularly, I think, in Republican primaries. But keep in mind in this case as well, we've got a blood feud that's been going on for a long time between Sarah Palin and the Murkowski family. She bumped off Lisa's father, Frank
Not
Murkowski.
Literally,
no, in a primary for governor after saying that he had basically betrayed the state. And she moved in aggressively against Lisa Murkowski in this case. And that probably made a difference. But remember, we're talking probably less than 100,000 votes cast in a Republican primary in Alaska. I don't want to generalize about the larger anti-incumbent mood in the country, particularly because we know that we're still likely to have 90% of incumbents reelected in the fall.
Right.
We don't want to take it too far.
There's also another issue that is salient in Alaska in this particular vote, and that is abortion, and specifically parental notification before an abortion can be given. You would think that Alaska already had a parental notification law, but here was this measure on the ballot yesterday, and this clearly brought out a very strong vote. It was passed about 55-45, but I think we have to say that 55% in favor of the measure were heavily concentrated on the Republican side. And this is one of the issues where Sarah Palin differed with Lisa Murkowski, and also, of course, where Joe Miller, the beneficiary of all this, differed with Lisa Murkowski. And so it appears that the enthusiasm of the anti-abortion forces in Alaska has been a major boost to
You're
Joe Miller.
You're saying Lisa Murkowski has been pro-choice all
the
way.
She has been much more of a moderate on abortion, although she favored this measure. She did not come out against this measure. She favored the parental notification measure, but she has a reputation as being an abortion moderate.
One interesting thing about all this is really the role that Sarah Palin has played in this. She has endorsed in a number of contests around the country. In some cases, she's been a big factor. She boosted Nikki Haley's campaign in South Carolina, Susana Martinez, the Republican governor nominee in New Mexico, for example. But she's also lost a number of races. More than her fair share, a woman named Karen Deal, the former Secretary of State in Georgia, she lost a runoff even though she had Palin's support. Endorsing Joe Miller was a big risk for Sarah Palin against the establishment, even though she is, for all intents and purposes, the most popular Republican in the state of Alaska. Endorsing against the incumbent, really putting a lot of her reputation on the line in her home state, is not something you're going to see Mitt Romney do. That's not something you're going to see Tim Pawlenty or any of the other potential White House candidates do. So it was a risk, and she deserves the credit. She didn't do a lot of campaigning for Joe Miller, but in the last few days, she sent out some fundraising appeals, cut a robocall that went to Republican homes around the country, around the state. That, I think, is going to prove determinative if Joe Miller pulls this out.
There's one other factor here that's kind of interesting that I think has had an impact on the policy process. These conservative activist candidacies against incumbents have pulled some candidates to the right and changed their behavior. We'll talk about that a lot, I'm sure, with John McCain. But Lisa Murkowski was one of the leaders in the global warming, the attempt to find a climate change compromise through up until this last year. Then she changed. And among other things, she was the sponsor of a bill to try and take away the authority from the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate carbon emissions. And she backed away from any meaningful negotiations. The only explanation that I would have for this is, even though she dismissed Joe Miller's challenge in many ways, that she was very cognizant of the changing politics in Alaska. So she that had a significant role in the failure to move forward at all on climate change.
Norm Martinstein, he's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email, your messages on Facebook or on Twitter. What about John McCain, Ron Elving? He, more than almost anyone out there, seems to have been shifting with the political winds on many of his positions.
John McCain got his wake-up call late last year when he saw what was going on in New Jersey and Virginia, and when he saw some of the energy that had been unleashed by what we call the Tea Party, many different groups of people not necessarily all connected to each other, but conservatives with a more libertarian view, certainly on economic issues at least. And he saw all of this being quite strong in Arizona, and he knew that there had always been a well of resentment against him in his home state because of his many bridges that he had built to the Democrats. And the sorts of things he campaigned on to a large degree when he was running for president, his ability to cross the aisle, his ability to talk to all Americans, all good things, really, and all the high end of political aspiration, perhaps. But when you get back to a tough primary in a pushback year, a swing back, a pendulum year like 2010, and you have even one guy like J.D. Hayworth, not a perfect vessel, not the best guy to test John McCain in Arizona, but when he was willing to do it, some of the early polls told John McCain he was in the kind of trouble we've seen Bob Bennett or Lisa Murkowski in. So he went pedal to the metal. He spent over $20 million, more than he had spent in all his Arizona races to date, primary and general. He spent money lavishly from his own fortune, and he beat down J.D. Hayworth by spending him down 6 or 7 to 1 and exposing Hayworth's flaws.
The key to John McCain, first of all, John McCain, he ran the textbook campaign. He did absolutely everything right. He owned the entire race. He owned everything about the discussion.
Early on.
He was spending, J.D. Hayworth was a radio host on a conservative station out in Phoenix called KFYI. Before J.D. Hayworth even got in the race, when he was still hosting his show, John McCain was running radio ads blasting J.D. Hayworth on KFYI during Hayworth's show.
Oh,
so the amount of money, the amount of effort he put into defining who J.D. Hayworth was really tremendous. I think there's a larger lesson here almost for Democrats around the country who are finding themselves in trouble, who figure out they have to figure out a way to beat these Republicans. They are going to have to do the same thing. They're going to have to run these negative campaigns.
Reed Wilson, he's editor-in-chief of National Journal's Hotline. We'll take a short break. I'm looking forward to hearing your comments. Just before the break, we were talking about John McCain's win. John McCain, the man who seemed for so long to be proud of the term maverick, he changed.
Well, he basically said he'd never been a maverick, even though he had authored a book with that in the title. You know, this reminds me, back in the 1980s, Fritz Hollings, who was, of course, a longtime veteran of politics, ran for president, had a very tough campaign against a conservative. And he said at the time, ain't nobody going to get to the right of Fritz Hollings. And John McCain basically said this time, ain't nobody going to get to the right of John McCain. And he changed his focus and his positions on almost every issue in which he had been a leader and had been proud to be a leader. He was a figure in trying to forge bipartisan compromises on immigration reform, on climate change. He was the champion on campaign finance reform. When the Supreme Court eviscerated his proudest accomplishment, he barely issued a peep, refused to move forward. forward in any way to try and do something about it. Even now, when there's an attempt to reform the presidential funding system, which is clearly broken, it's not the McCain-Feingold bill. It's the Feingold bill now. So McCain changed dramatically. He became probably the most harsh critic of Barack Obama and his adversary. He dropped most of the things in which he'd been working with Lindsey Graham, who has now taken over that mantle. And one of our most interesting questions ahead is what John McCain returns to the Senate. Will he continue down the path that he took to get to the right of J.D. Hayworth, which is no easy accomplishment? Will he return some to what he'd been before? And as he said this morning, that he's not going to take his constituents for granted anymore. That's an interesting question. One last point. Even though he trounced J.D. Hayworth in one sense, the fact that 3 out of 10 Republicans in Arizona voted against their party standard bearer on this longtime veteran would suggest that he's still got some work to do, and he may be lucky that he's running against a 32-year-old former local office holder in Tucson who doesn't have much money or much traction.
One of the points, to go back to one of Norm's points, the which John McCain is coming back to the Senate has become an issue in the Senate. There were a few measures that Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid actually put off the table so that they could consider it in September and October because people thought that after John McCain won his primary, a different John McCain would come back. So that's been a serious issue.
That is a serious issue, and the question is that a little too soon, September or October? I would think it is. And with all respect to Rodney Glassman, the former city councilman from Tucson that Norm mentioned, we do expect John McCain to be coming back in January, and he's going to be part of a much different Senate where you're going to have a very close to 50-50, I suspect, one way or the other, whichever party is in control. And there's going to be a body of people, 5, 6 people, 2 or 3 of them calling themselves independents outright, and 2 or 3 more of them acting as though they were. Ben Nelson, say, from Nebraska, and possibly Lindsey Graham, still from South Carolina, and perhaps John McCain will find yet another persona for John McCain's final chapter.
And yet, when you're talking about the new Senate, I think one of the other fascinating things is take a look at some of the new Republicans who could show up. Sharon Engel in Nevada, Rand Paul in Kentucky, Joe Miller in Alaska, Mike Lee in Utah, both of whom, if Miller emerges from his primary, both of whom are likely to join the Senate. These are not the typical. These aren't even Mitch McConnell Republicans. These are
not even Tom Coburn.
Yeah.
I'm not sure they're even Tom Coburn.
And Tom Coburn has at least worked with Democrat. He worked with Barack Obama, but these Rand Paul and Sharon Engel are not going to the Senate to make a lot of Democratic friends.
New factor. New factions.
Norm Ornstein, explain what happened in Florida.
Well, we had some very interesting dynamics in both parties. In both parties, and we had candidates who tried to win nominations spending enormous amounts of their own money. We had a Democrat who was trying to win the Senate nomination from the establishment candidate, the candidate of the establishment, Kendrick Meek, a congressman whose mother had served in the House before him. We had on the Republican side a nursing home magnate who poured $50 million to try to win the gubernatorial nomination. On the Republican side, that worked. Rick Scott eked out a narrow victory over Bill McCollum, who is a perennial office holder and candidate for office, who's the attorney general now, had served in the House, had run statewide many times before, very conservative. But Rick Scott basically overwhelmed him as an outsider and a businessman, which tends to work a little bit better in some Republican contests. And on the Democratic side, though, Kendrick Meek pulled it out. Now, this was partly because his opponent had made his money by betting on credit default swaps on a housing collapse. So, in effect, made his money off of foreclosed mortgages and lived, shall we say, a bohemian lifestyle, which didn't play too well with some elements of the Democratic electorate. We also saw the labor movement step in Florida and work very hard with boots on the ground to get a turnout that worked. But, you know, we're going to have Kendrick Meek showing that it's not always the case that pouring your own money into a campaign works.
What a strange place we've reached in history where Kendrick Meek is the establishment candidate in February, in Florida, rather. If he were to win this race in November, and I think he's probably third in the three-team league right now, but if he were to win, he would be the first African-American since Reconstruction to win statewide anything in Florida and the first African-American to be elected to a Senate seat since Reconstruction. So he does have some outsider credentials as well as being the choice of the Democratic establishment and supported by Bill Clinton and Barack Obama.
This is actually not a good thing for the Democratic Party writ large that Kendrick Meek has won this this primary. Had Jeff Green won, Democrats would have been able to overtly or subvertly, or covertly rather, get behind Charlie Crist, the independent candidate running for governor, who is leading or in second place in the polls right now, and really give him the support he needed to overcome the conservative Republican Marco Rubio. But because Kendrick Meek has won this primary, with President Obama's support, with President Clinton's support, now the Democratic Party has to spend money there on Kendrick Meek's behalf rather than on Charlie Crist's behalf, even though Charlie Crist probably has a better chance at beating Rubio.
That all may be true, but the Democratic Party had no choice. Jeff Green, once he had been exposed, not only for the way he made his money, but as Norm said, for the way he spent his money on his 145-foot yacht that went on a cruise to Cuba and cut through the coral in Belize, all these things. He had quite a story. He was not going to get elected to the Senate, and the Democrats probably should stand with the man who is one of their own and, you know, look like a legitimate party and try to get the best they can out of it. And if Crist wins, it's probably the second best thing that could happen.
Let me ask you all, was anybody out there in the primaries trying to win without money? Did money make all the difference?
Well, Joe Miller. Miller had no money. Joe Miller had, at some point,
$84,000.
I think total spending throughout the entire campaign, less than $300,000.
Money is making the difference wherever.
But in Alaska, it didn't, Diane. Lisa Murkowski outspent Joe Miller by 12 to 1. So there, admittedly, with 100,000 votes, it was the outside intensity that mattered. And Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin's endorsement was probably worth $500,000, which is which goes a long way in Alaska. But it's also interesting that these self-financed candidates in some cases can prevail, but often do not. Voters, after a while, when they see somebody pouring huge sums of money in, wonder what the deal is. What kind of game is somebody playing if they're willing to spend $50 or $100 million to get one of these offices that everybody condemns?
Right.
And that may have impact in California, where you've got two candidates trying to do that for governor and Senate.
Here's an email from Keith in Cleveland, Ohio. How can the media and pundits still be pushing the idea that the electorate is in an anti-incumbent mood when only 8 sitting members of Congress have lost in the primaries? Wrong.
Well, because usually none do. That's usually the case. Usually you don't see anybody go down the way Bob Bennett went down. You don't see anybody even stressed the way, even to the degree that John McCain was stressed, or a Lisa Murkowski case, or for that matter, Arlen Specter being chased out of his own party and then beaten in the other one, or down in Florida, Charlie Crist being chased out of his own party. So we've seen a lot of that activity this year, and usually there is extraordinarily little at this level of politics, partly because of the money imperative.
Here's an email from Elizabeth in Montgomery County. She says, I've been following Florida politics. I was surprised at how little outreach there was to the significant Latino vote there. Neither Alex Sink nor Kendrick Meek had a Spanish language ad campaign. Why do you think that is? Don't they need that voting bloc to win in November?
Well, they really do. And Alex Sink, the Democratic gubernatorial nominee, didn't have much of a primary at all. I think she took well north of 80% of the vote in the primary. The Hispanic vote will be a significant factor. It always is in Florida, but it will be especially this year because Rick Scott does not have the best relationship with Hispanic voters. He's come out in favor of the Arizona immigration bill, for a matter as an example, and that's going to be a problem in a state in which Hispanic voters have voted for Republicans in greater margins, largely because of the Cuban community there, the very large Cuban community in Miami.
Talking about immigration, that was one subject we didn't touch on in regard to John McCain. He shifted tremendously on that issue, Norm.
Well, he certainly did. And, you know, John McCain, back when he was trying to forge a comprehensive immigration agreement with Joe Lieberman and Lindsey Graham, basically poo-pooed the notion of a fence and, you know, looked for a way to provide a road to legalization for the 12 or 13 million illegals who are in the country. This campaign, it was all about the fence and all about a positive view of the Arizona immigration law. I mean, he did ads. He took the toughest possible stance. Ain't nobody going to get to the right of John McCain on this one. And that's going to, of course, once again, make it harder to get anywhere on this issue.
I always find Arizona to be a microcosm of the Republican Party at large. The party in Arizona is very starkly divided between conservatives who are more business activists, businessmen, and those who feel more strongly about the immigration issue. That is playing itself out in a number of races across the country. I mean, that's why we're talking about immigration in the New Hampshire Republican primary, Republican Senate primary, and you know, Kansas, it always comes up, and a number of states that aren't on the border and don't have the sort of immediacy of the issue that Arizona Republicans feel. But the split between the business conservatives and the anti-immigration activists is probably costing the Republican seats throughout the country. And as the party struggles to reinvent itself, even if they win big, win back the majority in the fall, they will still have to reinvent themselves. That's a battle that's going to play out, and it's going to make a big difference, not only with Hispanics, but with moderate independents as well.
Reed Wilson, he's editor-in-chief of National Journal's Hotline, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We heard during the primaries a name we've heard before, the son of former Vice President Dan Quayle. Ben Quayle is making his appearance.
Yes, 33-year-old Ben Quayle, who is the son of Dan Quayle, and I should also point out the son of Marilyn Quayle. People sometimes say he's the spitting image of his father. I think you could make the case he looks more like his mom and also takes more of the political attitude and, shall we say, personality
what
of his mother, which is more aggressive. His father, when he first came up in politics, was an amiable, affable sort of fellow, a smiling face. Later was cast, of course, as an attack dog as vice president to some degree, but it never really fit him. When he was first coming up in the Senate, he was elected in 1980. You know, he was a blue-eyed, blonde, great-looking guy who just got along with everybody or tried to. Well, Ben doesn't really seem to be going that route. Now, if you're in a 10-person primary for an absolutely safe Republican seat, you're going to have some sharp elbows. You're going to have some really tough issue talk you have to do. And all the candidates in this seat were doing it. One of them featured herself firing a firearm in her ads. I mean,
an automatic, semi-automatic, actually.
And looked serious, like serious damage was being done by this gun to at least this human target shape, not a literal human target. And so this was a tough race. And of course, it came out that Ben had in his earlier years, in his 20s, been putting up postings on a little site called DirtyScottsdale.com. This obviously did not help in a conservative Republican.
What's DirtyScottsdale.com?
It's a racy website where people put up postings with anonymous names. He chose the name of a porn star from the movie Boogie Nights, and he posted under that name. Well, he tried to deny it. Then it was exposed that he had. Then he said, well, you know, it was all just sort of a youthful indiscretion. His father and mother wrote letters to the Republican voters of the 3rd District of Arizona telling them, this is something in our son's past. He shouldn't have done it, but he's a good boy, and you can trust him, and he wants to do the right thing. And in a 10-way primary, that kind of name recognition and being the story in that fashion is good enough for about a quarter of the vote or a little less, and that's good enough to make him the nominee, and he would have to be the odds-on favorite to win that seat in November.
He recorded a pretty strong ad against President Obama.
He did an ad where he started by saying Barack Obama is the worst president in the history of the United States. That got a lot of attention. Obviously, in a Republican primary in a Republican district in Arizona, it didn't hurt him.
Even though 75% of the people in the primary wound up voting against him, their vote was split among nine other candidates.
And I will say this is going to be a very anti-democratic year, but Arizona's 3rd congressional district is not entirely safe. It has been contested the last two election cycles. Congressman John Shadegg is retiring. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has spent money in the district the last two cycles. They have a candidate there who's got some money. He doesn't obviously doesn't have the fundraising ability that Ben Quayle does, but if Ben Quayle survives this year and there's another Democratic wave in 2012, that could be a seat that the DCCC puts its focus on
down the road.
What kind of clear political understanding does Ben Quayle have other than being the son of the former vice president? What's his background? What's his experience? What are people voting for other than a name?
Well, Ben Quayle is a lawyer, and I think people, when they go to vote, are largely looking for symbols. They're looking for people who resonate in some sense with a value they're trying to express. And if there's a name, whether it's Murkowski or whether it is Quayle or whether in some other state it might be another name, they oftentimes respond to that. That's how dynasties are built. It's not necessarily that people think the talent transfers. It's the value. It's the brand. And so he has a brand which, among a certain kind of conservative Republican, is an embattled but one they're willing to defend brand.
Ron Helving, he's Washington editor for NPR. When we come back, we'll talk about what all this could mean for November. We'll take your calls, your emails, your messages.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose Kids Count is a state-by-state look at child well-being and the important role of data at AECF.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
A Reader's Review, V.M. Forster's A Room with a View. It's a novel of romance, travel, and comedy, featuring a young English woman in search of truth and passion. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. It's time for your calls, your comments on yesterday's primaries. First to Catherine, who's in Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air. Catherine.
Hello.
Yes, go right ahead, please.
Thank you. This is what I'm looking for in a candidate, and it's very unusual. Anyone who is pro-labor, I am voting against. I think it's insidious at the federal, state, and local level that the Labor Party, which is 23% of the vote in America, is the worst lobby we have, and it's a big one. They impact NAFTA. They impact school systems. They impact tariffs. They impact retirement pensions, that at 55, you'll get 80% of the salary until you die, while the taxpayer is struggling. So I've actually taken a look at candidates where pro-labor will get the vote out, and then the candidate will be extremely generous with all levels of decisions as a payback to labor to get them into office. In Ohio, we've seen this to an extreme, in Cleveland and at the state level. And I wonder what comment your guest has.
All right.
Yeah, Ohio has been a hotbed and will be this year for the pro and anti union move. I should say the pro labor and the pro business movement rather than anti anything. The Republican Senate candidate out there, Rob Portman, the former congressman, is also the former budget director for President Bush. His opponent is the lieutenant governor of the state, Lee Fisher, and Rob Portman's experience in the Bush administration is going to play a huge factor. As we move forward, Democrats are going to try to make it an issue, and Rob Portman has not been the biggest pro-union. He did not have the best pro-union voting record when he was in Congress. As a matter of fact, he had one of the best pro-business voting records. So the labor issues are they're going to play a big role for Democrats as unions come out and spend. AFL-CIO has pledged, I think it's $53 million on behalf of Democrats. So at the end of the day, it's going to play a big role for the Democrats, and it's going to play an especially big role in that Ohio Senate race.
You know, back before we had all the social issues that are front burner in our politics nowadays, oftentimes, and back when the two parties largely agreed on all national security questions, labor management issues in the 50s and early 60s were American politics. There were very few issues that didn't fall along a labor management divide. And the number of people voting on the labor side of that, I would argue, was quite a lot higher in those days. Certainly the labor unions in the private sector were much larger. In the government sector, labor unions are probably as successful as ever today. So I don't know if it's 23% of the vote in the country. Mm-hmm. I think that might be a generous estimate.
Here's an email from Ron in Grand Rapids, Michigan, who says, I'm sad to see the moderates, both Democrat and Republican, disappearing as there is no one to negotiate with. And the antics of the chameleon John McCain almost makes me afraid to vote for any party, as it's become very clear what you vote for is not necessarily what you get.
There are a lot of good points there. One thing that is happening is, for a long time, the center in the House of Representatives has been declining, and it's going to decline further and more rapidly this time. Moderate Republicans in the House, who have basically been able to caucus in Mike Castle's bathroom, moderate Republican from Delaware, who's now running for and a favorite to win in the Senate, will go, and there aren't very many others left. Those who are left basically, and there are a number who'd like to work out compromises, but they would be devastated in primaries if they did. The vulnerable Democrats in the House are concentrated heavily among the blue dogs, the centrists there, including some who voted against their own party, Stephanie Herseth Sandlin in South Dakota, but is in trouble simply because she's a Democrat. And while we're going to get a couple of moderates in the Senate, a couple of moderate Republicans, as Reid said earlier, they're going to be outnumbered by the bomb-throwing, uncompromising types.
So,
and it's going to be very hard to find those compromises in the middle.
All right. So what does all this mean, then, for the government to get anything done?
Well, what this also speaks to is a diffusion of power outside of Washington, D.C. The Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee have much less control over the rest of their party than these diffuse groups. One group that's gotten a number of candidates elected, Sharon Angle in Nevada, Joe Miller if he wins in Alaska, etc., is a group called the Tea Party Express, this political action committee in California that's raised and spent millions of dollars on behalf of very conservative candidates. That's taking away from the National Republican Party. So when they are able to go into different primaries in different states, you've got Elisa Murkowski in serious danger, and Bob Bennett not even making the ballot in the primary because he got kicked out at the convention. So it's going to be a really different 112th Congress. When they come back in January, the freshman members of the House are going to have been swept in on a populist anti-government wave. The freshmen in the Senate are going to be these Rand Paul, Sharon Angle, Joe Miller, Mike Lee types. Even though they're not all likely to come to Washington, D.C., a significant number of them will. This place is going to look very different, even than the partisan rancor of the last few years.
All right, to Hershey, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Tom.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Glad to have you.
I think ordinary voters should be appalled that John McCain can spend $20 million in a primary. I think that's what's wrong with politics. And, you know, people are struggling all over the country. And to watch that kind of money, that's not winning an election. That's buying an election.
John McCain used to think that was what was wrong with politics, too. But things change, and politicians become devoted to maintaining their own career, if not necessarily maintaining all the positions that they're associated with, and he certainly has become a poster boy for that. I think, though, that there needs to be, over the next several years, an uprising of this caller and all the other people in America who feel that the money issue is becoming a separate issue. Ever since the Supreme Court decided that money and speech were in some sense legally synonymous and that you couldn't restrict money too much because it was like violating the First Amendment to the Constitution, we have been on a increasingly slippery slope. The current Supreme Court has opened the floodgates and indicated that even disclosure of who's giving the money to whom is not necessarily a settled matter.
And that's the candidate spending money is one thing, but we're going to get an enormous flood of money thanks to the Citizens United decision, thanks to Justice Anthony Kennedy and his cohort from outside groups. Karl Rove has set up two groups with Ed Gillespie, both called American Crossroads. One is American Crossroads itself. The other is American Crossroads GPS. The second is, in the IRS parlance, 501c4, a nonprofit that can engage in issue advocacy and you don't have to disclose the donors. They've raised $17 million already headed towards $50 million. It's all going to be poured into harshly negative ads against Democrats. There are going to be some on the other side, but it's the outside money, in many cases with no sense of where it's coming from, unlimited corporate donations that are being allowed. And because in many cases they don't have to disclose those donations, they're going to be more willing to give them. That's appalling.
That Jane Mayer has a piece in this week's New Yorkers on the billionaires giving money to conservatives. Let's go to Oklahoma City. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, Diane. The last little discussion here just really kind of turns my stomach. I wasn't planning on talking about that, but gee whiz, the Supreme Court has sold us out with some of these decisions here. They've sold this country lock, stock, and barrel to, the people who can afford to pay the most. I would like to make a comment about, I've seen some ads from Mark Rubio. He was kind of wearing the Hispanic cloak, showing that he represents, a lot of Hispanics there. I would like to have you comment about the preferential treatment the Cuban Americans get versus other nationalities, other Hispanics that come into the country illegally.
Well, Cuban Americans play a big role in Florida politics, and that's the community from which Marco Rubio comes. He was the Speaker of the House. He built a reputation when he was in the state legislature as not quite the conservative that he's displaying himself as now, but he's certainly far to the right of Charlie Crist, as I think are the majority of activists, Republican activists around the state of Florida. One interesting role that Cubans, Cuban community in the Miami area is going to play this year, as I said earlier, is how they react to this gubernatorial candidate, Rick Scott. There are three Cuban-American members of Congress, all Republicans from the southern Florida area. They were not in favor of this this anti-immigration bill in Arizona, and it's that interplay is going to be very fascinating. It is a traditionally Republican voting bloc. If they start to swing away, I think that signals a impending disaster for Republicans around the country who have had a decreasing, a degenerating relationship with Hispanic voters ever since Jim Sensenbrenner's bill back in, what, 05, 06?
What about state legislatures? We haven't talked about them, but they're going to... Are Republicans going to make big gains there, Ron?
Just as Democrats made big gains there in 2006 and 2008, this year the pendulum swings back. There are a lot of state legislatures where the normal relationships, the normal ratios between the two parties have been rather lopsidedly upset in the last two elections, and that's going to be addressed. That's pretty much natural. If you combine that with the energy and with the flow of media message that we're hearing in 2010, it could be rather extreme. I've heard it estimated that perhaps 500 seats could change hands between the two parties in the 50 state legislatures. Nebraska only has a unicameral legislature, but there are lots of folks in it. So that could also be paralleled by a big shift in the governorships. Right now, the Democrats have a bare majority of the governorships. They're going to lose that. And they could drop down as low as into the teens, just as we're on the brink of the post-2010 census redistricting, the reapportionment of Congress, and then the redrawing of the lines in every state. And in some states, Pennsylvania, Georgia, a number of others, this will determine who has the upper hand in those delegations, and that'll determine who runs the House.
There's no doubt about that, and there's a lot of money, a lot more money than we normally see going into state legislative races as a consequence. And, of course, we have many chambers that are within one or two or three seats of a shift in majority, and we would have to expect that those states especially are going to get the heavy treatment.
You know, as we talk about money, and you mentioned this earlier, Norm, the governor's race in California, you've got Meg Whitman putting in millions of her own money. You've got Democrat Jerry Brown, who spent, what, $1,000?
Yeah, this is an even greater contrast than in Alaska. Meg Whitman has spent now close to $100 million so far, and there'll be much heavier spending to go. The big winner in California is the local television station community, and they've had this experience before when Al Checky, another multimillionaire, ran for governor and lost. He spent about $60 million and bought television ads at, you know, the full price, so it was a godsend for the stations. For Meg Whitman, running against a quirky Jerry Brown, she ought to be in a very commanding position. But I don't think you could say at this point that she's in a
really
commanding position. I think you still have to rate her as a favorite, but that may be a case where there'll be a little bit of a backlash. Interestingly, by the way, she's spending a lot of money in Hispanic advertising in Spanish language. She understands that the California community is a little bit different.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Waynescott, New York. Good morning, Jordy. You're on the air.
Good morning. I love your show, Diane.
Thank you.
I wanted to say that it seems to me what's going on, I hope I can verbalize this briefly. You have a lot of very wealthy people running for office, often with conservative point of view, and they're hostile to government, but yet they're running to be in government. And what happens is that they create a government that's non-functioning because they become roadblocks at every step. Plus, they take all the advantage of government for themselves. So while one woman called up and spoke against unions, which provide benefits for working people, the people that are running for government, now the wealthy people, which really don't need the unions, they'll take all the benefits from the government, which they'll have all their lives. And I think that I see government as useful. Government helps poor people. Government helps middle-income people. It provides rights and protections for them that wouldn't exist without the government. And I think that a lot of the wealthy people running for office now really don't. The government interferes with their business.
You know, it really does go back to Ronald Reagan when he said, government is the problem. For you.
This reminds me of an old P.J. O'Rourke quote in which he said Democrats are the party that say government can make you stronger and smarter and healthier and get the crabgrass out of your lawn, and Republicans are the party that says government doesn't work, and then they get elected and prove it. This is a fundamental debate in politics today is what is the role of government. It was a debate in which John McCain and Barack Obama clearly disagreed in 2008, but I think reading the 2008 election as a referendum on the role of government was inappropriate. I don't think you can make that leap. It was a change election, as opposed to now we're having a serious conversation about the role of government. And at the moment, the populists in America are reacting more to, as I think it was Ron said earlier, the TARP vote back in October of 2008 than anything else.
Yeah, it was the TARP vote, I think, really was a key here. It suggested to people that those in government were rewarding the miscreants who had gotten us into this mess, who took away our savings and our homes and kept us from even being able to sell them when we need to. And they not only bailed them out, instead of following that by riding them out of town on a rail after tar and feathering them, let them take those bonuses. But then you've got the GM bailout. And even though that's proven to be an enormous success, it saved an industry hundreds of thousands of jobs and other things, you've got a backlash against that as well.
So what do these primaries tell us?
These primaries tell us that this anger that we've all been talking about is still highly generalized. It's very strong. It's in almost every corner of the country, but it does not always produce the same results in terms of specific candidates and how they try to tap into it.
Ron Elving, Washington editor for NPR. Norm Ornstein, he's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Reed Wilson, editor-in-chief of National Journal's Hotline. More to come, gentlemen.
Absolutely.
Thanks for being here. Thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.